Tuned in to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is Free City Radio. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of June, and I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. We broadcast every Wednesday at 11 o'clock here on CKUT, people-powered radio in Montreal. I'm recording from a cafe because right now we can't be in studio, so I'm going to hear the atmosphere. On the program this week, I spoke with author Eric Larson, who has recently published a book called The Operating System, an anarchist theory of the modern state. That's out via AK Press. It's a really important work, I think, because it breaks down ideas around the centrality or the legitimacy of the state. I think a lot of questions have come forward in relation to that, surrounding the pandemic and the capacity of governments to respond to people's needs. I think this book is timely. It's important. The write-up about Eric's book says, this is, I'm reading from it, one of the most unique aspects of anarchism as a political philosophy is that it seeks to abolish the state. But what exactly is the state? The state is like a vast operating system for ordering and controlling relations among human society, the economy, and the natural world. Analogous to a digital operating system like Windows or Mac OS. Like a state, an operating system governs the programs and applications under it and networked with it, as well as, to some extent, the individuals who avail themselves of these tools and resources. So I think it's an important framework to think about the state in relation to possibilities for alternatives and also the shortcomings that we've seen in the context of the pandemic so clearly. Eric is a longtime activist and author based in New York City for many years. I got to know him around the anti-corporate globalization movement. And particularly around the protests against the World Economic Forum, which were moved to New York City in the winter, early winter of 2002, right after September 11th. It was in January 2002, those protests. So I called Eric about his new book out on AK Press, and I will feature that interview today here on Free City Radio. Here we go.
I think it's so helpful and important that you're looking at actually defining and naming both the state infrastructure and how it controls life and our relationship to the natural world, beyond just smash the state or critique the state or dismantle the state. You're trying to name it. And I guess maybe we could start with the point of why, for you, is naming that system important and defining that system? Why is that important for sort of activist frameworks of action and organizing? Why was it important for you to put that out there through this book?
Right. Well, there's two reasons, really. And one has to do with just being an anarchist myself, which is that what differentiates an anarchist from a socialist of another sort or a Marxist or even a liberal Democrat is the fact that as anarchists, we are very specifically opposed to the state. We're opposed to a form of political organization that's top down, even if it has democratic features to it, that regulates and enforces rules on us that we're not the authors of. And that's been a position that's been a differentiating thing for anarchists for over 150 years now. But the question is, what do we mean by the state? And it seemed to me that there's a couple of things that are a problem here. First is that there isn't really, other than a few writings here and there, there's not really an anarchist theory of the state. There's never been a sort of a really rigorous effort to sit down and say, what do we mean by this? What is it we're opposing exactly? And this comes up constantly in terms of, you guys have some interesting political ideas. Why don't you run for office and try and get them introduced? We don't do that because we're against the state. Well, what is the state? Why are you against it? So that's kind of a problem that comes up in our interaction with other politically active people all the time. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that, and this is really the important point, I think, is that the state has become a more and more powerful institution over the 500 or so years that we've really had the modern state.
Sure.
It's more pervasive. It's more controlling. It's more sophisticated in its approach. It's more destructive. It's more capable of violence. I could go on about this, but we have an entity here that is that pervades our lives that we don't entirely understand. And it seemed to me that this is a contribution that anarchists can make is that other people have overlooked, because we don't start from a point of view that the state is. It's just what we have. It's to mm-hmm. be taken for granted. You know, mm-hmm. it's part of our natural system. We don't look at it that way. We look at it, the state, as something that we critique, that has to prove itself, that it has to prove to us that it is a worthwhile thing to continue to have. You can go from Marxists to neoconservatives, and there is a common agreement there that at least for now, the state is just, it is what it is. It is what we have. And we don't do that as anarchists. We don't start from that premise. So it seemed to me that we're ideally located to have this conversation about what is this thing. Once I got into thinking about this in a serious way, I started to really collect string on it.
Sure.
What I realized is that the important question that nobody's really answered or attempted to answer for a long time is, what are the boundaries of this thing? Let's start with the boundaries of the state. Okay. What is included in it? Is it just government? Is it just the cops? Is it just foreign diplomats? Is it just bureaucrats? Mm-hmm. What is it? Mm-hmm. What is included in it? What actually makes the decisions that make the state the state?
Yeah.
And I realized that the modern state is something that we've come to think of it as essentially government, but it's not just that. It includes a lot of other things. I think that on the left, there's a tendency to regard the state in a kind of a Marxist sense as being something that the capitalist class created or exploits in order to get its way. You can either say it's the handmaiden of capital, or it's the executive committee of the ruling class, of the capitalist ruling class, something like that. I think that the state is something bigger that includes capital. Capital is part of the state. It's, in fact, the state itself is a capitalist. If you look at its history, especially its early modern history, this becomes clear. Mm-hmm. Capital has huge influence within the state.
Yes.
But ultimately, the aims of capital and the aims of the state are the same, are more or less, are essentially the same. Mm-hmm. And that capital is one of the things that pursues the aims of this larger thing that I call the state. One of the things I do in my book is a little tricky, I hope not too tricky, is that I make a little bit of a differentiation. There's states with a small s, like Canada, the United States, the UK, et cetera.
Sure.
Then there is the state with a big S, with a capital S. And what that is this entire system that essentially sure. all states are part
sure.
of.
Sure.
One of the things that I ran up against again and again and kind of trying to trace this history for myself is that there's a tendency by historians to emphasize, when they write history, the conflicts between states. The times they go to war, there's so much history that's,
sure.
that's literally chronologized around, in between this war and this
sure.
war and so
sure.
forth.
Sure.
Actually, the real story here is the way states cooperate with each other, the way they mimic each other, mm-hmm. cooperate with each other, work together to create new kinds of institutions and diffuse them.
Got it.
And export them all over the world. There's a kind of a cooperation or a symbiosis here between states that has created something that now has covered almost the entire world.
Yeah, it's like a coalescing of forces of power and sort of the convergence of interests that cross borders. And I really appreciate what you're saying about thinking about the state as beyond sort of like traditional colonial border lines and how that infrastructure of power has translated in the contemporary era to the economics of contemporary capitalism and colonialism that has really, as you said, overtaken much of the territory that humans live on the earth. I want to maybe just highlight a few points that you said. And I think like one thing that might be interesting to focus on here in terms of your book, Eric, is just this idea that the way I would put it is like often, you know, when power feels unaccountable, if we're talking about like, you know, the power of an institution or the power of a government or a police force, et cetera, corporation, the ability that people's movements have or activists have to question the fundamentals is more limited, especially when you accept the frameworks of the quote unquote legitimacy of that power. And I think, you know, a lot of the critiques and ideas that, you know, you've outlined in this discussion and are detailed in your book, The Operating System and Anarchist Theory of the Modern State, I think creates space for us to actually have more possibility to actually address the injustices that are connected with this infrastructure of power of the state. And I think that that's so important to think about because, you know, in this time, you know, whether it's in Canada, we're talking about, you know, the Canadian colonial state and the injustice of the colonial history in regards to residential schools, or in the United States, if we're talking about the systemic racism that shapes institutional policing in regards to racialized communities and particularly Black communities. How do you reform those structures that are so inherent in the formation of this state project, right? So I think some of the ideas that you're highlighting really speak to the ways that that sort of critique opens up space to actually give more power to that bottom-up critique. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah. I've got to say that Stefan, the way you've summarized it is absolutely central to what I'm doing here. It's the idea that if we understand this thing better, then we have a much clearer idea of how to escape the state, how to get beyond it, how to make the reforms that the state doesn't seem to be able to make or doesn't seem to, to want to make.
Yeah.
We understand better the challenge in front of us when it comes to creating the kind of society we want to. And, you know, a very good example of this, of course, is the police. You know, I do spend a bit of time in my book talking about the role of the police, both as a kind of a cultural force, as a way to cement the loyalty of a particular constituency, namely middle and working class white people, to the state. The police have become, certainly in the United States and many other places, has become a focal point of loyalty and of emotional attachment in this country. If you ask 8 out of 10 people in the United States whether they trust politicians, whether they trust government, whether they trust, you name it, big business, they will say no. But if you ask them, do you trust the police? Even today, after Black Lives Matter and after the death of George Floyd and the protests, you find a comfortable majority of white people in this country saying that yes, I trust the police. I believe that they represent me. They represent my interests. That's one of the ways that the state cements its power, is by creating a kind of an emotional bond, at least through one of its institutions, to these key constituencies. I should say there's a concept that I have in the book that I give a rather clunky name to, which is the core identity group. And it's one of the things that I find in just about every state in the world that has any kind of viability these days, is there is generally one constituency, one ethnic group or religious or identity group that is essentially the sort of the core support for the state. There's a tacit understanding that if that group's support is lost, the state can't survive. In this country, it's very much white people of European descent who are middle class to working class. those people many of them may suffer from the operation of the capitalist system. Many of them may have all kinds of reasons to want to identify some other way, but the state, through institutions like the police, creates an emotional bond with them. And that's absolutely vital to the dynamic that I'm describing here. So, and that gives you a little bit of an idea of the kind of the subtle ways that the state works. It mm-hmm. works on us in all kinds of sophisticated ways to maintain our loyalty, or at least our acquiescence in what it does. Mm-hmm.
It's not the only, I think the framework that you're illustrating, Eric, is really important, because we see, for example, the tendency globally that is happening around populist movements is entrenching that sort of like interest group that is aligned with state power.
Yes.
And we see what violence that can create in terms of sectarian violence and social violence. I think the sort of pattern you're talking about has been really pushed, and there's an entrenchment of that sort of framework of identitarian state politics we're seeing, for example, in India with the BJP, you know,
right.
And
right.
I think that that's a very important example, given India's importance in the world historically and in a contemporary sense too. But, you know, it leads me to sort of bring up the issue of why is it important to think beyond the state? Because, you know, for example, are there possibilities of having a progressive state? Is that actually something that's a possibility? I mean, this is a discussion, but it's an important one to have, because you think, you know, in the India example, if we think about the Indian constitution after the victory against British colonialism, the preamble, just the preamble, is very, very progressive, you know, and
sure.
many governments. Also, there's aspects of the foundation of Mexico that are quite progressive, or you could even interpret parts of the colonial Declaration of Independence in the United States as progressive. I mean, of course, it's based on land theft and dispossession. However, there are some...
Not to mention slavery.
Absolutely. Yeah. So those frameworks of... Yeah, so I guess why is it important for that sort of thinking within social movements that your book's trying to address, from what I understand, to think beyond the state? Why is that important? I mean, you talked about it in terms of like the systems of power, but like often this sort of question is just sort of disregarded or put to the side, you know? Why is it important? Like this for people who are sort of like plugged into quote unquote woke culture today, to think about those fundamental questions of like state power as possibly illegitimate.
Right. Okay. Well, I've got to get back to one fundamental point in order to address that question first, which is that what is the engine of the state? What does it try to do? And what kind of a world is that created for us? And what kind of challenges does that create for us? My thesis about this is that what differentiates the modern state from other kind of forms of social organization before it is that it's tremendously economically driven. The state was established as a way for sovereigns to build economic assets, to generate economic growth, which in turn enabled them to field armies, to extend their control within their own boundaries, to expand their boundaries, and to amass power. Sure. In doing so, they cultivated capitalists who could raise money generate businesses, mm-hmm. and help build that, generate that kind of economic growth that the state wanted. The more growth you got, the more the state had to expand, the more capital it needed. And so you have this symbiotic relationship between government and capital, which we've yep. had for over 500 yep. years now. Mm-hmm. So, okay, what does this have to do with your question about where can we go next? Okay, in order to generate economic growth the way the state does, it needed to do certain things at different points along the line. One was to expand colonially and start to cultivate slavery. That was one way. Another way was, you know, in Eastern Europe, to reimpose serfdom, which had been something that was dying out, which is related to slavery, in order to develop this large-scale agricultural production that it needed. So there's been injustice all along the way that's been built into this system. Also, the state, right from the beginning, almost from the moment the modern state appeared, it was a colonial, imperialist, expansionist state. I say at one point in the book that the greatest export that Europe ever created was the state, because it's essentially exported that form of social organization all over the world.
Yeah.
And it's only accelerated. You can look even 100 years ago, between 100 years ago and now, the pervasiveness of the state has increased hugely. Now, what does that leave us with? That leaves us with three huge problems that this state capitalist system has created. Number one is climate change, because one of the big accelerants of yep. this economic growth that the state and capital have generated has been fossil fuel.
Yeah.
And the use of fossil fuel. Yep. And that's something that it has not been able to wean itself away from.
Absolutely.
Because it can't find anything else that works as efficiently for it. Number two is income inequality, and economic inequality, which has soared. Mm-hmm. Especially in the last couple of centuries. Yes, there's been middle classes have developed in different places, but the amount of economic precarity, even for middle class people, has increased hugely. And that creates a kind of an inherent instability for the state.
Yeah.
The third thing is population movement. One of the key tasks of the state is to regulate populations within its borders. That's something that started right from the beginning of the modern state. That was when passports and internal papers were developed during the Renaissance, was for people moving across borders. That was one of the original kind of administrative elements of the state. And today, we have, especially in the last 50 years, we have population movement and migration around the globe that's soared. And that has one of two consequences, one of which is it could create a truly multicultural society that could be a very rich development. On the other hand, it could result in even more enhanced economic slavery. It can result in sweatshop societies like we've never seen before. Yeah. We do see them in places in the developing world. It could lead to a huge impoverishment and even more sort of ethnic violence and warfare than we've seen in the past.
Yeah.
These are challenges that all three of these are, I think, are existential challenges for the human race, frankly,
yes.
that have been generated by the state and by capital,
yeah.
Working within the state. And we can't afford to let these go forward.
No.
And that's essentially we're, I think, faced with a decision right now is either we get beyond the state, we escape it, we think of a different way to organize ourselves, or we suffer the consequences of these three huge challenges. That's the dilemma that the state has put us in after 500 years of its history.
Eric Larson, thank you so much for speaking today. This book looks great, The Operating System and Anarchist Theory of the Modern State, out via AK Press. Their website is akpress.org. And really appreciate you taking the time to talk today, Eric. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Stefan. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
That was a conversation with Eric Larson from the recently published book, around the recently published book, The Operating System, An Anarchist Theory of the Modern State, out via AK Press. I think it's an important book for this time to think about critically our relationship to the state, given all the shortcomings that were made very clear in the context of the pandemic. The book is out through AK Press, and I'm happy to feature it here on Free City Radio. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of June, and I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. We broadcast every Wednesday at 11 o'clock on CKUT, people-powered radio in Montreal. We'll be back next Wednesday. I'm going to go out with a piece of music from one of the musicians who signed the recent Musicians for Palestine letter, which I helped coordinate with some friends around the world, musiciansforpalestine.com, musicians globally standing up for Palestinian human rights. I'm going to go to a piece by Toon Yards, who's one of the artists connected to Montreal for some time, who signed the letter. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 11 o'clock. I'm Stefan Christoph. Do stay tuned for the F-Files, which is coming up next. Take it easy. I'll talk to you next week.
C-K-U-T. Oh, what? C-K-U-T. C-K-U-T.
So my name is Bea, and I am being interviewed for a voice and movement practice that I've been facilitating for the past 5.5 years, I guess, at this point. And I work between sound and dance. I used to play in a band, singing and making music, and now I'm in kind of hibernation mode from that. I created Womb Core when I was like 22 and was really stepping into a lot of frustration about things that I felt were expected of me, like having a baby or being in a particular kind of sexual romantic relationship.